Today's episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
All right, so puzzle boxes.
Puzzle boxes.
Puzzle boxes. I'm going to say this from the perspective of somebody who actually solved a Rubik's Cube when I was a kid, but it's my opinion that people who not only own Rubik's Cubes but solve them tend to be real assholes about, like, I solved a Rubik's Cube. I put my colors together like I'm still in kindergarten. Like, have you ever walked in on, like in somebody's office and they've got their fucking solved Rubik's Cube on, like, a platform or, like, a stand? Like, they're showing it off like a fucking trophy?
Okay. Can't you fake that, though? Because when you buy a Rubik's Cube, it comes solved.
Yeah.
I know you're supposed to mix it up and whatever, but I mean, if you were really a pretentious asshole, but didn't want to put in the labor, you just buy yourself a Rubik's Cube and just set it on your desk and be like, look what I did.
I mean, if you're lying about solving a Rubik's Cube, you're a pretty pathetic human being.
I think it would be hilarious to see the solved Rubik's Cube on someone's desk and just come in and fuck it up for them.
Well, you solved it once. Go ahead.
Exactly.
That's why. All right, I want the LaMarchand box.
You don't?
I do, because I want the LaMarchand box, and I want to go to a Rubik's Cube convention, and I want to be around these pretentious assholes who are like, I solved a Rubik's Cube, and I'm like, bitch, I solved the LaMarchand box, now the Cenobites are going to come and kill you. Like,
no, but they wouldn't come and kill them, they would come and kill you.
Well, they probably kill everybody.
They only come after the person who solves the box. True.
Ooh, then I should.
That's why I'm saying you gift it to someone else.
Yeah, then you
gift it to the asshole.
Yeah, then we get the LaMarchand box to the Rubik's Cube person and be like, yeah, you solved the Rubik's Cube. Why don't you solve this one?
Exactly.
That'd be
fun. Yeah. My grandfather had a puzzle box. It was not a LaMarchand box. It was just a puzzle box. And I used to spend a lot of time, you know, like pulling it apart, because you have to do like a whole bunch of different steps in order to open it. And I was always disappointed because he kept nothing in it. It was purely decorative. And I was like, what is even the point of having a puzzle box if you're not gonna fucking hide something in the puzzle box?
I just think about what would Pinhead's reaction be to one of those Rubik's Cube people. Like, I solved the Rubik's Cube, and Pinhead, I mean, I can just hear him like,
well,
save your tears.
I think the real question is more like, what would that guy's Cenobite profession be? Because, you know,
you don't think it'd be Pinhead coming after him?
Well, no, I think that Pinhead would come after him, because that's apparently his job. But what I'm saying is, like, you know, we learn in Hellraiser 2 that when you're dragged into whatever this weird Cenobite hell is, you're attacked by the weird tentacle box or whatever in hell and transformed into a Cenobite. like you're changed according to whatever weird predilection you had back in life, right? So what did the Rubik's Cube assholes become when they're taken into hell?
They'd become Rubik's Cube. The dude would be like, but I solved a Rubik's Cube. And Pinhead would be like, in hell, you are the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, they just crank his arms into weird angles and stuff. He becomes a contortionist.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Slate House Publishing Presents Lit Bits. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Trevor.
And today, guess what? We're talking about the benefits of Mr. Rogers' Imagination Land. No, I'm just kidding. We're talking about Clive Barker's Hellraiser books and stories.
You really stumbled through that intro.
I did really stumble through that intro.
Clive Barker, that's what we're talking about.
We're talking about Clive Barker. So I think what I want to start doing is talking a little bit about why these works are important that we're choosing. So I want to say this. So why is Clive Barker important? And why did we want to talk about him today? And my idea is this: like, horror in the mid 20th century was pretty standard stuff. We've been inundated with ghosts and werewolves. William Peter Blatty's Exorcist was a novel idea. And it was based on a rumored exorcism that took place in the 1940s. But it still came at us from this like purely Christian theological perspective, right?
Well, I think to challenge that just a little bit, right? What we're really talking about with Barker is like the evolution of certain tropes or certain assumptions about horror, because that's really what he does, right? He takes common tropes, or he takes ideas that have been around for a long time and kind of spins them into this new area of excess. And I think that's really, right. really interesting. From the, to your point about the Christian perspective, right? I think most of what we understand as at least American Christians, or even to a certain extent, maybe like a European Christian, right? It really, our sense of Christianity, our sense of Christian theology doesn't even necessarily come from the Bible or biblical texts, but from other authors who have innovated on the ideas taught in theological seminary or taught through theological study. You know, he kind of takes these, or they take these ideas and run with them, innovate upon them, and then they take on this, I don't know, this kind of fresh luster for a lot of people. They spread through popular consciousness to the point that we can't necessarily discern between what is original and what is derivative. So for example, right, I'm thinking of John Milton in Paradise Lost.
Right.
Our whole concept of Satan and Lucifer and the conflict between a heavenly host and a satanic being, or, you know, this grand enemy, comes from like John Milton. We don't have
biblical... I would probably argue Milton and Dante Alighieri.
Well, but Dante very, yes, his vision of hell is the other side of this coin, but Dante never really wrote about Satan or some kind of divine enemy, right? Like Dante was still very much grabbing hold of these other theological ideas from the Greek and Roman pantheon, and blending them with Christianity. So our idea of hell really is far more, I think, represented in Dante's work. And then, of course, Dante's work, I think, went on to influence a lot of artists that have crafted similar visions of hell to Inferno. I mean, it was like the blockbuster kind of epic
But even
story.
By the 20th century, all of these ideas are still very, very old. Like they're very...
Oh, absolutely.
Like when Blatty writes first The Exorcist and then they do the movie, that vision of demonic possession feels... It's novel at the time, but it also is based on literature that has been pushed as biblical truth for like years and years and years. Yeah. So that's what made it scary for some people.
Well, I think it also made it scary because to Blatty's credit, he set everything in our homes, right? He set everything in our neighborhoods.
But what really fascinates me is as much as Blatty is showing us horror from like the, as from the perspective of the dutiful Christian. And yeah, I know the priest in there has his own conflicts and people have crisis of faith, but it's still coming at it from this perspective. Barker is the flip side of this. Barker is the other face of that said coin.
I think
he's showing us with the same amount of awe and reverence the demonic that we're used to paying, like, or people are used to paying in church.
Awe is the word I would definitely use here, right? That has a very specific meaning that a lot of people miss, right? Well, when we say something is awesome, I mean, we think of like Ninja Turtles, right? Because the popularization of the word awesome has become, you know, so commonplace that we've lost its meaning. for something to be awesome, it means it inspires you with awe. And the idea of awe itself is this kind of almost an out of body feeling, if you will, where people are just completely taken out of their ability to fathom themselves in a place, in a space, right? Mm-hmm. There's this kind of elevation of self to something beyond, like a confronting of the infinity or the infinite, you know, outside of the self. So in a religious context, right, a lot of religious interaction was built around trying to provoke a feeling of awe of God, awe of his infinite being, right? You go to a cathedral, you see Gothic architecture. It's supposed to fill you with this sense of wonder. It's so huge. It's so magnificent. It's so artistic. We're taken up breathless,
right?
By the presence. And I think that Barker is serving that same kind of reverence. And I think that he innovates on ideas regarding hell, ideas regarding one's relationship to extreme vice, right? Yeah. In the same way that Dante Alighieri was way back when with the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, and I think in doing all of this, I feel like Barker really helped redefine horror. I mean, Stephen King called him the next great thing when his Books of Blood came out. Barker really kind of set the stage for like what was coming next. I mean, he moved away from like the known horrors that we had been experiencing. And I feel like he gave us something new and something very, very uncomfortable to look at. Especially with The Hellbound Heart, which is the book that it's going to be the number one source for our topic today, our look today. We're not looking at all of Barker's pantheon of work. We're looking mainly at The Hellbound Heart. We are going to talk a little bit about the Hellraiser movies. First, I think I want to get into the biography of Clive Barker and tell people a little bit about who he is. Do you want to tackle that,
Herbert? Yeah, sure. Clive Barker was born in Liverpool, England, in October of 1952.
Happy belated birthday.
Yeah, we just missed the window on that.
Yep.
I'm sure he would have appreciated a shout out on our super growing podcast. he's a playwright, novelist, film director, visual artist. This guy has tackled so much in by way of art. Mm-hmm. I think prolific in some ways, especially in the way that he continues to grow his craft from a multimedia perspective.
Like, we mentioned Candyman in our summer movie.
Candyman was one of his stories.
Yeah, it was called The Forbidden.
Mm-hmm. Hellraiser, of course, is very well known, although admittedly he only had a hand in I think those first two or three movies before...
He wrote and directed the first movie, and I think he was like just a consultant for like the second one, and then I think he dropped out after that. And...
Yeah, I believe that sounds correct.
Yeah.
He's produced video games even, mm-hmm. Really contributed to a lot of different and very interesting horror projects. I think his first real breakout fiction was The Books of Blood.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also had The Hellbound Heart, which is the novella we'll be talking about, the basis of the film Hellraiser.
And for the if any of you are interested in The Books of Blood, which is where Candyman, The Forbidden, can be found, Books of Blood are still... sold the first three volumes are sold as Books of Blood, but and it just says 1 through 3
in the United States.
In the United States, volume 4 is available in the United States, but it's called The Inhuman Condition. Volume 5 is sold as In the Flesh, and volume 6 is sold as Cabal. So yeah, they changed the titles up, but you can still get all 6 Books of Blood. He was also, to add a little bit of pedigree to this, he was also the executive producer for Gods and Monsters, which won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. So he's got some accolades behind him, too.
And I think some of his fiction also has quite a bit of accolades, if not formally. I mean, critics absolutely love Clive Barker.
Yeah, yeah. He's very, very influential, and he's very, very well regarded.
He's such a distinct voice in fiction.
But We are talking, like Trevor said, specifically about The Hellbound Heart today, which was Clive Barker's novella that was then turned into Hellraiser. So Hellbound Heart is about a pair of brothers. One of them is a naughty boy.
To say the least.
He seduces his brother's wife right before they're to be married. So the actual line in the book goes something like this. It's like, the difference between what Frank did to Julia and rape was her acquiescence. And that to me is such a, it's like a thematic statement for this book, because there is no differentiating between sexual pleasure and suffering and pain and the horror that these demons bring and that hell brings.
Yeah.
This is so intertwined.
Yeah.
In the story.
This, I think the short form summary is essentially, there's a dude who is real into earthly pleasures, who finds that there's no more space for him to go. So he looks up this strange supernatural box that promises unearthly pleasures. He opens the box, he finds out there's a bunch of demons there, he's taken to hell, and the rest of the book is his effort to get back to Earth using the unwitting help of his brother's sadistic wife.
Yeah. Man, what a gruesome story. Do you want to talk a little bit about the themes real quick that we?
I mean, sex is totally a theme, and also the kind of sinful nature of sex. It's really interesting how he delves into the sexual politics of this book, because he presents it in such a light that there's almost, at least for Barker and the sense of these characters, right, there's almost no wholesomeness to their interaction with one another. Everyone in this book is kind of after their own pleasure, their own desires. They're motivated entirely by their desires, and those desires are quintessentially selfish, I think.
So, I mean, is that his point, though, do you think? Do you think he's really saying that sex and pleasure and gratification is inherently selfish?
I think so. I mean, that's kind of the reading that I get. I like, when it comes to his delineation between sex and pleasure and pain, which this book features very prominently as a story of excess, right? Like, that's where the horror really derives, the inability to discern for these characters, and certainly for the hellish minions that show up in the book, between these two extremes, right? Like, that's some of the idea that Barker's trying to dig into.
Okay.
I don't know. It's real creepy. Help me out.
I think you're right. I mean, the most innocent character I think that was in there was not Frank, but his brother's kind of naive about the whole deal, isn't he? I mean, he's kind of innocent. I mean, Julia is definitely not innocent.
What was the name of the brother in the novella? Because they change it.
Yeah, they change
something
it in the movie.
Really, it's like Rory in the
Rory,
book.
Rory, yeah, I think it is Rory.
And then they change it to Larry in the movie, right?
Yeah, Larry's just a little less British, but we'll get into the movies. We'll get into the movies here in a minute.
I don't think Rory is an innocent character.
I didn't say he was innocent. I said he was the most innocent.
Innocent, but still extraordinarily selfish.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Because if you look at each of the, because there are only four main characters. I mean, the cast of this novella is really quite small. There's Rory, the husband, who is a well-meaning but kind of stupid husband. He's recently married to his wife, Julia.
Mm-hmm.
Julia is a sadomasochist. I mean, she's maybe just straight sadist.
Yeah, she's
she's real twisted.
Yeah.
She has no love for Rory. Rory views her as a possession, right? Like, Rory is really...
She's the trophy wife.
She's the trophy wife. He's only really interested in her so much as how she makes him feel.
Yeah.
Julie is not interested in Rory because she feels like he's too timid or too weak or too uninteresting. I'm not really sure what Julia's beef with Rory is, or maybe it's just that Rory just kind of sees her as an object, but she's attracted to...
He's a bit vanilla too.
Yeah. I mean, she's attracted to Frank. Frank's a total asshole. He literally rapes her on her wedding day, right?
Yeah. Or like right before the wedding dress is on the bed. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. He rapes her right next to the wedding dress, and she... In the moment, it's rape, but she kind of turns it from not being rape in retrospect, which I think is really, really kind of crazy. I think she turns whatever victimhood there into motivation for her sadism. Like, she's really quite messed up.
Yeah. And then the girl, Kristen?
I think it's Kirsten.
Right? I know. So... My nephew has a girlfriend, and I have a niece, and one of them is named Kirsten and the other one's named Kristen. And hey, if you're both listening, I'm sorry. I can never get your name straight. One of you is one and one's the other. And just people quit naming your kids K, like K names. Just stop it. It's tried out. It's tired out.
We got to retire the whole letter K.
We have to. Yeah. And I say this with my wife's name being Carrie, which is, and your wife's Kate.
My wife's Caitlin. We're just... What's really funny is that for a long time there was an actual betting pool as to what letter of the alphabet I was going to end up marrying, because I dated a string of M's. It was like almost exclusively M names, and sometimes their initials were like MM. Like it got to be a whole thing, and it's not like I chose that on purpose or anything. It just kind of happened that way. And then I married a girl with a K name, and I really shot to hell that pool. A lot of people lost a lot of money.
So, I mean, maybe I should amend them what I said. Rory is an innocent character, but actually I think Rory and, I mean, he's not an innocent character, but he's more innocent than, or less selfish, I guess, than Julia and Frank. But same would go for Kirsten. And
again, I think that Barker shows us that Kirsten isn't even all that innocent a character either, because she's constantly looking for a window to sleep with Rory.
Yeah,
she's constantly looking for a way to sneak into this marriage.
The best thing he ever did was making her Larry's daughter in the movie. I think that provided a character that we could actually review.
Yeah, it removed the sexual tension.
Well, that
from the
tension.
Novel. Well, yeah. Between those characters in the novella, and it made her. Oh, that's so. It was. Oh, that's so gross.
So bad.
No.
Come to daddy.
That just skeeves me out so bad.
I think it's meant to. I think it's meant to skeeve us out.
Over on the Sip and Smut podcast, whenever they actually release, they're constantly talking about like the pet terms, and every time I hear them talking about daddy, I cringe. Like I crawl up and die inside.
So I have been talking a lot about the objective correlative. In fact, it's kind of been my running theme this whole season so far. So, and if we all, you know, just another refresher, it's the T.S. Eliot thing. It's the outside that mirrors the in, or the internal. This idea really takes a literal kind of visceral meaning here.
Oh my gosh,
it's really
so
freaking
literal.
This is gruesome. Like when Julia finds Frank, like for the first time, because he's died and he's found his way back from hell, but he's not like a normal. Like, he's not, hey, it's me, I'm okay, I'm Frank, come to daddy.
Like in pieces.
He's in pieces. He's like, he's been skinned. His flesh has been torn asunder. He's like not even a shell of a man, because it's really just his innards. Like, the shell's been stripped away. And so he tasks her with, they discover by accident, both of them, that blood can actually kind of fill him up and bring him back to his whole kind of self. So she takes this this opportunity to like sleep with men and bring them back, or like seduce men. Yeah, she doesn't sleep with them.
She seduces them. She brings them back.
She brings them back to the house and then murders them. And then he like sops up their blood and gruesomeness and gore to like reanimate himself.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's very, very, yeah. It's, and Clive Barker, while the
this is not reading for the squeamish.
No, no. And while the prose can be really beautiful in this book, man, the imagery, he does not hold back on that. It's no. It's really, really
highly
gruesome.
Effective.
But yeah, there's
I mean, the objective correlative. I mean, you see externally all of this viscera, right? Which I think taints the relationships between the characters, because the characters are just as tainted by all of this violence and all of this this, you know, insatiable lust or desire. You know, I think all of what we see viscerally played out on the page, you know, mirrors the internal kind of viscera of these strong sinful emotions, right?
Right. Yeah, it's very well done imagery to reinforce that idea of pleasure and pain being so intertwined. You know, like they go hand in hand, or I don't know, maybe chain in hand, or like needle in hand. Like Pinhead, like, I know he's got the chains, he's got the
acupuncturist. See what you're going for. I call him the acupuncturist, because every time he shows up in the movie, I assigned a profession to all of the Cenobites in the movies. And if you've seen the movies, you know what I'm talking about.
They're all like secondary medical specialists.
That's right. There's the
acupuncturist. There's the ophthalmologist.
The ophthalmologist.
The guy with the glasses. Right. There's the dentist. He's the dentist. Guy that, like, with the teeth.
His teeth or his mouth is just like flayed open. All you see is like.
And then there's
teeth.
The lady with the hangers coming out of her head or whatever.
Yeah, I couldn't quite figure out what she was. Maybe your dry cleaner. I don't know. I'm not entirely sure.
Although a dry cleaner is not really a medical professional, but
it's not a secondary med. Maybe she's just the orderly.
Maybe she is. Yeah, she's the orderly or the nurse or the CNA or something.
yeah.
So yeah, maybe I don't think we can. So the book and all its gruesomeness, I think that's about almost everything we can say about it without really giving too much away.
I mean,
it follows the first movie really, really closely.
Once more, we're really spoiling a book that's 40 years old.
I know. Well, we got to quit doing that, man. I mean, there are
nobody's going to ever read anything we have to talk about.
Well, it's like that one lady in the mail said she didn't have to read anything as long as we talk about it.
Oh, that's true. You know what? You're welcome for our service.
Yeah. So if you've seen Hellraiser, the first one, and they're remaking it, by the way. There's two. I've heard there's a lot of controversy too. There's two remakes coming for it. Like one is definitely through Hulu. That one's got the big controversy. And then one is, I want to say it's like HBO or Netflix. It's something like that.
Is that right?
I think so. It's going to be like a series.
I've not heard of two. I've heard that there is a remake coming, and a lot of people are really upset about the casting of that.
Because the
priest character, the Pinhead character. I hate calling him Pinhead because I think it's such a dumb sounding name.
Well, and Barker even says in later works that Pinhead hates the nickname Pinhead. So he doesn't want to be called Pinhead. So I'm sorry about that, Pinhead. We will never call you Pinhead again, Pinhead.
I just feel like Pinhead is, I feel like that's an insult that you should reserve for someone you really hate.
I mean,
like Rudy Giuliani.
He's literally got pins coming out of his head. Pinhead does, not Rudy Giuliani.
Rudy Giuliani could have pins. I've been shocked about Rudy lately.
People are upset because
we really have.
People are going to discover it 100 years from now.
They're like, why are they so obsessed with a former governor of New York?
So people are upset because Pinhead is going to be played by a transgender actress, right?
And I feel like I could go either way about this.
But Clive Barker says in the book that these are genderless beings.
Oh, sure.
I mean,
I don't think that's what upsets me. I think what maybe upsets me, and the only reason why I might be upset about the casting, is simply that I think there's I don't know. I think there's some weird sexual politics at play there. I don't want to villainize transgendered people and cast them as like these weird sexual villains, you know, sexual demons, because I think that's very unfair to the trans movement. That is the only real reservation I have about the casting, because otherwise, I mean, I don't know. It's also kind of interesting or weird, the sexual politics of the novel and the movies, because Clive Barker himself is homosexual, you know, and I think in some ways at
he
least
he worked, did you know, as a male escort for a time.
I did not know that.
Like, when
but
he couldn't
it
pay rent, he
it
was...
wouldn't shock me, to be honest, knowing
so
his fiction.
So for me, that's exactly why I think like this transgender actress kind of works for this role.
Yeah,
because it shows that even through the casting, they are involving this sexual tension, this sexual politics that are so
well, and
rampant
how much
in
of
the
this,
book.
How much of this is also kind of leaning very heavily into this idea of Christian allegory, of sex being... you know, like one of the great deadly sins. There's really nowhere, I think, that the Bible addresses sex as being a negative thing. I mean, there's conversations about jealousy or about envy, you know, in the Bible. There's, you know, the idea of lusting over someone else, but I think that's more... I forgive me, feminists who are listening to the podcast, but I think that's more about property ownership and property rights than it actually is about the actual act of sex.
Well, Leviticus, I think it's one of those Itticuses of the Old Testament goes
How
into...
How many Itticuses are in the...
I don't
Old
know.
Well, it's just Leviticus,
it's
right?
probably just Leviticus. It's either Leviticus or Deuteronomy, which itself, just that name by itself kind of sounds dirty, doesn't it? Deuteronomy.
I don't know.
It kind of does.
Maybe
I don't know.
Maybe it's because I've,
but it's
I've
one
spent
of those...
more time with the scholarly, you know, aspects of analyzing.
But there,
the
it's
Bible.
About the laws that are handed down, and
right.
So there's this whole list of you shall not lay with or thou shalt not lay with, you know, so and so, so and so, so and so, so and so, so and so.
I think in like contextually, those all just boil down to property rights.
Property right. I'm going to go one step further because somebody else made this argument for me that I'd heard once. Property rights and medical like health. Like, so for a long time, people were told in like that Old Testament thing, like, and I don't want to turn this into a Bible podcast, but that's for another podcast.
I do want to turn this into a Bible podcast.
They were told for a long time, like they couldn't eat pork. But the main reason for that was because right. they didn't have the proper methods to sterilize the pork so that they could eat it without getting sick.
Yeah,
and I think that's what the purpose
of like
of a lot of the,
yeah. Yeah.
And I think there's a hygienic rule behind a lot of these laws. Like you aren't prepared mm-hmm. for this. You are going to, if you do this, it's going to make like some issues. And so I feel like that's probably the basis for even some of those sexual laws.
But I think that, you know, to Barker's credit, I mean, he draws on a lot of that as allegory for this story, you know, because homosexuality in most traditional Christian circles, even today, I mean, 40 years after he wrote this novella, people are very unaccepting of homosexuality, and they depict it as one of the greatest of sins. I think the same goes for, you know, like transgender identity.
Oh yeah.
In the church today, it's, you know, there are a lot of people who are very unaccepting of these things, and I think that turning something like
the Kardashians
sexual union,
are totally against it.
Oh, that's sad.
So the first movie, we're talking about the remakes, but the first movie to come out was directed and written by Clive Barker.
Right.
And he did it. I mean, it was pretty decent. I mean, it had some issues. It's very dated.
The acting is really quite bad.
The acting is bad.
There's a lot of weird soft lighting that I think really, like, he does not frame a whole lot of scenes very well. And as a result, you know, there's that kind of that light bloom on a lot of those movies from that era. That just speaks to me of like, you don't know how to work a camera quite right. You don't know how to maintain the right kind of focus or whatever. I don't know. I'm getting real nitpicky here, but I think visually speaking, it's not very
I mean, the special effects are
special effects are fantastic. But I think other than the special effects, the visuals of the movie are really quite amateur.
So, in all fairness, neither Trevor or I saw, at least I don't know if you went and saw it after, but neither Trevor and I saw any Hellraiser movie after Hellraiser 2.
No.
Because we watched Hellraiser, and then we watched Hellraiser 2 so that we could talk about this. And my God, was that a fucking mess.
Hellraiser 2 was absolute garbage. I couldn't tell what the fuck was going on with that story.
It picks up like moments after, like right after Hellraiser, the first one.
Yeah.
And except it kind of doesn't, because at the end of the first one, like the house burns down.
And then it doesn't.
And then it's
it
just there, and in the first one, they're in London, and then they're in retcon. some like American town or city. Like in the second
it's
one,
it's so bizarre. I can't place them. I don't know where they're supposed to be in the world.
I don't think they knew where they were supposed to be. Like I don't think they had a clue as to what was going on.
Oh my gosh, this
and then you
have
the
mess.
Weird psychiatrist who's got like this 18th century like mental hospital kind of thing going on.
Yeah, but I don't. How did that guy keep that hospital open? Because it like very clearly it's the 1980s, right?
Yeah.
Like we are told through the film it's the 1980s, and yet this guy's running around in like a 19th century psych ward.
Yeah,
it's like made of concrete.
People in like old like it looks like a dungeon. It looks like something out of like Arkham Asylum. Like the people like behind these like ironclad doors,
it's
and
super
they're just
cartoonish.
Oh man, it's bad. And then he decides he's going to like...
Cartoonish even for a movie about demons, sex demons from hell.
Yeah. That would have been a better title for
sex
it.
Sex demons from hell.
Sex demons
that's
from
the,
hell.
That's it, believe it or not, that is the name of my porn tape.
I'll take your word on that one.
not even my wife will watch it. It's probably because of the makeup.
That's like a Rodney Dangerfield joke. Yeah. Like, my porn tape's so bad, not even my wife will watch it. It's like, yeah, I mean, God, Hellraiser 2, what a freaking mess. And then there's this like...
My favorite scene in the whole movie is when they come up. What's the girl's name? The puzzle girl who's like
a the one that doesn't genius. Speak?
Yeah, she's like a savant at puzzles.
Yeah. And if you're writing a movie about demonic puzzle boxes,
like,
you have to have a savant with
puzzles.
This
is how bad the movie is. The movie is so bad, I literally do not remember the name of the main character.
Yeah, it was the girl, right? I mean, it's the girl from the first one. It's Christy.
No, it's because Kirsty or whatever is the main character. But there's the other puzzle girl who becomes the main character of the story because of her weird, knowledge of puzzles.
Yeah, and then the psychiatrist ends up bringing back Julia, who's in the same state Frank was in the first film.
Right, but my favorite scene is when the psychiatrist is showing Kirstie around his facility, and she's just like, she's cool with it. She's just like, yeah, this hot doctor wants to show me his mental institute. and they show her the girl, and they're like, oh, this is... blah blah or they're like, this girl, you know, she doesn't speak, she's really into puzzles, and they're like, we don't know her name, you know, we call her blank. And then Kirsty follows up and she says, but what's her real name? And like he just explained to you he doesn't know that girl's name, number one. But number two, like, you're like, what's her real name, whatever they named her, like, it's just such a stupid, it's in a nutshell, it is quintessentially why this movie doesn't work. It's so stupid.
Well, then they give the savant puzzle girl the Le Marchand box to solve to bring the Cenobites.
Right, yeah.
And here's the thing.
Talk about a Chekhov's gun. You see the girl and she's like, I'm real
Julia
good at puzzles.
Knows,
so I wonder what's going to happen there.
Here's the deal. Julia, here's what doesn't make sense to me. Julia knows what the Cenobites are. She's seen them. She's seen them come, right? They got her in the last movie. So she's escaped. She's in the same predicament as Frank is.
She's seen them come, and I was like, I was like, wait, what, did I miss that scene? I was confusing it for my sex tape.
That was the sex tape version. That was the porn version of
I watched the wrong version. I should have known not to try to stream Hellraiser 2 from Pornhub. That should have been my first indication that maybe it was the wrong bootleg.
The Cenobites are coming. Yeah, they are.
Yeah, they are.
Don't waste your time.
We
with
are
that.
Really earning that explicit tag this week.
I think we are. I think I'm shooting for it.
Cha-ding!
Yeah, don't. Our basically, folks, don't watch Hellraiser 2. I don't know about this new Hulu version. I hope it's going to be good. I'm not bothered by the. I think this will be an interesting choice. But then again, it is Hulu, so they have hits and misses. I don't know. I want to like it. I like the first one. I love the novella.
The first one was really fun.
If you can stomach it, read the novella.
The novella is so good.
The prose
though.
Is very beautiful in there. As disturbing and as disgusting as the imagery is, his prose is terrific.
It does everything I think horror should do. You know, whether you want to look at this as some kind of allegory about the villainization of sex and the villainization of you know, homosexuality or the, you know, kind of the prominence of homophobia or just conservative ideas of sex, or if you just want to read it straight as a scary novella about some fucked up stuff, it's great. It's so good. It's honestly one of my favorite books that I've read this year.
Yes, mine too. And so hopefully we've convinced some of you to go out and maybe pick it up and check out Clive Barker. Don't shy away from him. He's gruesome, but he's a really good writer.
Yeah.
We want to thank everybody for listening today. We've got some more stuff coming up. We're going to have a special Halloween episode coming up. I think we're going to try and get that one out on Halloween, so you might get a couple episodes this week. You know where we're at on social media. We keep telling you every week. We've got our Patreon. Thank you to all our Patreon subscribers. We've got a few Patreon subscribers now.
It's amazing.
Not many, but a few. So we do appreciate all of you. We have, you know, the Buy Me a Coffee, and you guys are following us on Twitter and our different iterations and on Instagram and Reddit and TikTok. Yeah. So we really appreciate all of you. We've got the anthology coming together right now. And we're just really excited about everything that's happening with Slay House and how it's progressing. And so we want to say to everyone who's involved with it and to everybody who is supporting it, thank you all very, very much. Thank you to our producers at Wayne Howard Studios. They are terrific. They are above board. They are top-notch guys, really professional, and we really do appreciate everything they've done for us. So really just thank you. I feel like I can speak for all of us when I say the best is yet to come. Like, yeah, no pun intended.
We're having a blast. And
unlike the Cenobites, the best is yet to come.
Would you say that they're the worst to come?
Well, I don't know. I never watched them come. So
I'm going to walk outside before I make another joke about sperm. Bye, guys.
Bye.